Welcome, friends. This is James Corbett of CorbettReport.com. It is the 3rd of June 2013, and today it is the 3rd of July 2013. My, how time flies. And today we're joined on the line once again by Dr. Thorsten Patberg of Peking University. And longtime listeners and viewers might remember that we talked to him on GRTV last year, I believe, about language and imperialism and cultural imperialism. Very interesting topic in a lot of different ways. And we have him back on board for another interesting interview and conversation. So, Dr. Patberg, thank you for joining us.
Good morning, James. Good to be here.
Excellent. Well, it's great to have you here, and especially good to have you here to talk about Chinese-American relations at this very sensitive time, as so much is happening right now with regards to, of course, the recent revelations about NSA spying, etc. This is a very interesting piece of information to come along at a very interesting time, especially as just last month, Xi Jinping and Barack Obama were meeting in California, talking about, amongst other things, cyber relations between the two countries. And people out there probably have seen there's been a big buildup in the media over the past few years now about Chinese hacking into American computers and the Chinese hacking threat. And yet now we have revealed, but from the inside of the NSA, the fact that, in fact, the NSA is monitoring communications that are passing through other non-governmental organizations in China, including Tsinghua University, one of the six major internet hubs there in China, where millions of communications pass every day. This is a major scandal by any means. So this is a definite interesting piece of the whole Chinese-U.S. relations to come along. And it's probably going to affect them in a big way, but I'd be interested in hearing your take about what we've seen in the past few weeks and where things are likely to head from here.
Right, right. Well, there are a lot of things going on, obviously, about this NSA case in China in particular. The U.S. basically accused China of internet spying, which is not news. I mean, every secret agency in all the countries probably do it, but the trick is to find evidence for that. And now the U.S. is accused of having a double standard because they obviously spied on China all the time. And not only on China, by the way, they also spied on their allies in Europe as well, which is maybe even the bigger phenomenon. We come to that in a minute. First, about the Chinese-U.S. relationship. I want to make this clear from what I read in the Chinese news, the newspaper and the media. It is very clear, I believe, to the Chinese that Snowden is a traitor and a whistleblower. I heard some opinions and rumors in the web. Maybe he's not, and maybe he's just there for speaking truth unto power. But that is actually not the case in China in the official version. He is a traitor and he's a whistleblower. Make no mistake about this. Everyone knows it. And so there is the public opinion in the microblogging world in China that, of course, takes great pleasure actually in blaming the U.S. for double standard and all that. But they all know very well that he is a traitor and he is a whistleblower, and that is a legal case.
So why do you think Snowden went to Hong Kong specifically? Do you think there was any reason for choosing that as a destination?
It's at the moment, to be frank, it's all kind of guesswork. We don't know. Maybe he made contact long before he actually left the U.S. We don't know this. And actually, there are some allegations, we don't know if they're true, that he even contacted other governments before that. And so there's nothing we can really say about this, you know, like all these things will happen behind closed doors and will be negotiated between the authorities in Beijing and in Hong Kong and the U.S. I'm pretty sure about this.
Well, let's turn to another interesting revelation that just came out 2 days ago from Bloomberg, who is quoting some anonymous inside sources from within the Obama administration that apparently there has been a 2-year buildup within the administration trying to create this Chinese hacking meme, and they were going to roll out this big campaign that they were going to start, and perhaps even leading to the indictment of Chinese hackers. But that seems to have been significantly derailed by the recent revelations. It would be very difficult, I think, for the U.S. to pursue such a campaign in the midst of their own hacking and spying allegations. What do you think, ultimately, the Chinese government response is likely to be to this? And do you think the Chinese people are concerned about what the NSA is doing?
Yes, they are concerned. But let me put it this way. They are very lucky that it happened in Hong Kong and that Beijing could officially just say we have nothing to do with it. Although, of course, they played some strings in the background. But they are, you know, Hong Kong is so far away from the political center, Beijing, that it actually it was a master move to have them have him there for a couple of weeks and then let him go and say we had nothing to do with it. Probably they had something to do with it. This is undeniable. About the relationship between China and the U.S., I think this case is very sensational, yes, but it will not affect core business. It will not affect political engagement of the two parties. You know, they have to talk regularly. And it will not affect economic ties. I don't believe it. This is really a media sensation at the moment. And you mentioned that Obama was in close talk with Xi Jinping, of course. But, you know, you have all these U.S. celebrities coming to China. I mean, last month we had Albright at Peking University, and now Kissinger, Henry Kissinger, is again in China. So there's all this talk going on, and the friendship is still there. I mean, it will not be interrupted because of this case. I don't believe it. Mm.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the internet in China then. Obviously, this is a big issue for people in around the world who look at China and look at the censorship of the Chinese internet. What's your take on this issue?
Well, to be honest, it's painful because I'm at Peking University, and you would expect more openness from a university of such name. But the truth is, we don't have what we typically associate internet with in the West, like Facebook and Twitter and YouTube. You don't have this. And Google, using Google in China is a very painful experience. You get to 1-2 search results and then it's over and it crashes and you have to restart. It's always like this. And then the internet connections in many places, they're not good enough. If you leave, you know, if you leave companies or if you leave institutions, you go on the street, you find an internet bar. The internet is so restricted for the ordinary people that it's just painful to watch, yes. And last couple of years, you have to register for all social media that the Chinese have, like Weibo, Sina, and Youku. You have to register with your own name, and you always have to give your passport number. And this also is for civilian purpose, of course.
So maybe the NSA is only helping to filter out some of the messages that are flowing through the internet there.
Yeah, well, that's right.
It is very interesting, and I think it's a case where I don't think any government has the moral high ground to be lecturing another government, because they're all spying and they're all surveilling, and China is also filtering out the internet, so I don't see how they have any kind of moral high ground on this issue. For the average user of the internet there in China, there are certain ways that people can get their voices heard and get their ideas out there, and there are success cases of people bringing down local politicians and corruption scandals through Chinese social media, etc. So can you speak to the power that the internet has brought to the Chinese citizens and whether this is a hopeful sign?
Oh, yes, there are hopeful signs. There are more internet users in China than in the U.S., and there are much more microbloggers, actually. 400 million microblogs in China. That's a ridiculous number, right? So what are they doing, actually? I just mentioned this before. They have their own Chinese internet, let's say. They have their own Chinese company that care for the search results, like Baidu. This is like the Chinese version of Google. Now, what do you find with Baidu that you cannot find in Google? And if you really do a research on this, this is fantastic. It's like two different worlds. Google would never show you search results from China, right? Wouldn't make sense. American people, they would expect search results to be closer to their own culture, to their own authors and journalists and so on. And China is exactly the opposite. Baidu will, of course, first give you the information about the Chinese authors and journals and medias. So they're completely different worlds. And sometimes, you know, I'm thinking, oh my, this is really interesting. I wish the guys in New York would read that, you know, like, but they don't. It's completely separated. And also the media world, the Chinese have 2,000 more major newspapers. It's a ridiculous number. So they're very well informed, and they're talking a lot, and there's a lot of freedom as long as you don't criticize openly the government, yes.
Well, then tell us about the culture that is developing online in China. What does it look like? Is it primarily young people who are involved in this, and in what way are they shaping the culture in at large?
The middle class in China, they're shopping on Alibaba. They're shopping through the internet. And they all have their microbox. It's like part of life. It's like having a mobile phone and having your microbox. And they have other technologies, other apps they download. And we all know how popular the iPhone is in China. And Samsung, of course, is a big market. So sometimes, you know, when I go back to Germany and I see the Europeans, like the Chinese in many ways are more advanced in using these new technologies than the old Europeans are.
Well, let's talk about some of the changes that have been ongoing in China now for a couple of decades. Pretty remarkable transformation of a society. In fact, the largest country on earth by population, and I think pretty significant changes that have been made just in the past decade. And now we have the new president, Xi Jinping, coming out and saying that he is vowing to achieve the Chinese dream of great rejuvenation of the Chinese nation. The Chinese dream, of course, is an interesting phrase, a very loaded phrase for the Americans in the audience who obviously understand the American dream. Let's talk a little bit about this phrase, and what do you think Jinping means when he talks about the Chinese dream?
Mm. First of all, this Chinese dream is for the Americans. This is very clear. They don't know how exactly made this phrase up. They say it was an American journalist in some paper. Someone said somewhere Chinese dream or China dream. And this is a mirror for the American dream, of course. The U.S. seems to go down culturally, political, military on the world. There's a loss of influence, of power. And the Chinese are going up, and this is the Chinese dream is now the new version, let's say, to replace maybe the American dream. If this can happen, we don't know. But I want to say very clearly that actually Xi Jinping never said a China dream or Chinese dream because he speaks Chinese. He said something like a Zhongguo Meng. So the Zhongguo Meng is discussed in China every day now, in all the newspapers, you know, among the people. So what is this? And a lot of jokes actually around about this, you know, because in Beijing they say, well, the Beijing dream is all about having clear air and clear water. So it's not precisely clear what he means. He always talks about the great rejuvenation of the Chinese nation that you just mentioned. So this includes Greater China. This includes all the Chinese people, the diaspora in the world, the Huaren. The Chinese people call themselves the Huaren, like, you know, some concepts. Like Caucasian or whatever. So there we have a nationalistic element, you see. So it's very difficult to define this Chinese dream. If you talk about economics, of course, every Chinese wants to drive a car, own a house, and all this what is included in the American dream. But we also know that it's not possible. The Chinese have a completely different history. They have dynasties. They had emperors. They have a completely different set of religion or traditions, as we know, Confucianism, Buddhism, Taoism, and all this. So when they dream, they actually dream slightly different things from what the Americans dream. That's what I believe.
Well, it's obviously a different cultural context with a different history. How much do you think that history weighs on the current actions of any individual government there in Beijing?
They're very historically aware, like they should be. This is, you know, this is very normal. The Americans are also very historically aware. They base all their decision on, you know, past events and, you know, the Civil War and the Constitution, Bill of Rights and all these things. So you see, everyone is referring to his own cultural development and history. Of course, the Chinese have all the right to do the same, if only the U.S. government would sometimes listen to that, right? The Chinese are very still not assertive enough in world history. The government is all about, you know, the past humiliation by the Europeans, and this all runs so deep in their heart, you know, like this is something they have to overcome still. They still feel passive, and they want to be recognized in the world. And this is all part of this Chinese dream, you know, to get a voice in the world.
Well, people often talk about how China thinks in terms of centuries when they plan their strategies. Do you see that as part of what's happening right now? Because there's been an incredible change in Chinese society, even in the past couple of decades, that seems to go in the face of that thinking.
Yeah, I believe that a lot of Chinese thinkers and strategists at this moment can be very relaxed about it. They have long-term plan, and it is like, how to say this, like maybe, I don't want to go now into this democracy thing, but obviously they figured out for now a way to advance at an incredible speed in world history, and they will replace the US as an economic superpower soon, already. So, but what comes after that in way of cultural terms, we don't know. But I'm sure the Chinese have this relaxed attitude about history. They existed for 3,000 years, maybe 5,000 years, some numbers say it differently. But it is just a continuation of the Chinese. Yeah.
Has there been any indication so far in the tenure of Xi Jinping as to what type of president he's going to be, if there's going to be any sort of radical change in direction of Beijing right now?
Hmm. You mean in, well, it's hard to tell. He's a different character than the whole group that came before him, obviously. And he has good ties to the US. This is what they build on now. The relations is very good. You know, he's like, how to say, also, we know his son is also studying in the US, you know, and there's a great admiration. And there's so much cooperation on every level you can imagine that I don't think there will be a big fraction or big clash. There won't. It will be cooperation mostly.
Very interesting. Well, I'm very much looking forward to seeing how this plays out in the coming years, because obviously I think the Chinese-US relationship is going to be one of the driving forces in global relations, increasingly so. And there's a lot of different ways that'll play out, not only in the hacking scandals, but also I think in Syria and other places like that, where China is getting more of a seat at the table. Well, I've brought up a lot of different points, but is there anything else that you'd like to cover in this conversation?
Definitely, I want to talk about Europe, because you just said it very clearly and rightly that it's all the story about the US-China relation. So what happens to the other parts of the world? I'm German. I'm always, you know, worried about the development of Europe. And we have to say this very clearly, that Europe somehow falls back. And this is a tragedy. This is no good for no one. And in connection with this NSA spy case, we see it very clearly that the US spied heavily on countries like Germany. They even spied more on Germany than on China. Like, how about that? And of course, they spied on France and all this. So there's a huge backlash now from the European governments that feel kind of betrayed, because they're allies. They are not the enemies. And now we have voices like the French president, François Hollande. He said it's unacceptable. The US has to apologize or stop this immediately. And then, of course, we have the Germans. Angela Merkel sent her spokesman and said that it's not okay. We have the European Union. They believe that they should build some kind of, you know, a consensus to stand up as a whole of the European Union against this surveillance by the US. But does anyone really believe this is going to happen? They are fractioned. And because they are fractioned, they're vulnerable. Each country in the European Union now actually looks to the East for economic survival. The Germans in particular, they have increased their activities in China so much that they are totally, I would say, totally dependent on the Chinese markets now. The British service, same. The French have to catch up. You see, like, they all have to depart a little bit from the US now and look toward China. But I am worried that they are kind of fall between the chairs. Always worried about that.
Well, it's a good point, and the point is taken that for the past few decades, at any rate, it has been a basically unipolar world with the U.S. dominating economically and geopolitically and in every other way. Now that there is another player at that table, partially so, someone like China, does that mean that we are moving to a bipolar world, a two-polar world? Is there a difference that's developing not only economically but geopolitically because of that?
Yeah. it will develop, it must develop. That's what I believe. It's and also the case of Japan. I mean, we are both now in Japan. We're talking, we are on Japan soil. We know that the Japanese development also is quite, you know, like, how to say this? At the moment, it's unpredictable. What will they do? You know, because they obviously have to split a little bit from the US. They can't be, you know, they're still occupied in a way, and a lot of people don't like this. They can't be forever under the umbrella of the US, you know, defense. They have to do their own thing. And of course, they're very close, despite all these political factions, but culturally, they're closer to the Chinese than to the Americans. So what will the Japanese do as a very powerful force in Asia? What will they do? So that all the cards on the table, we don't know what will happen now.
We don't, but it is going to be very interesting to see what will happen in the coming years. But you see fundamentally that rather than a necessarily competitive relationship, there are signs that the Chinese-U.S. relationship is going to be more cooperative?
Yeah, they have to. Actually, it's a good sign that the USA is spying so heavily on China, right? I mean, that this is all about economics. They're not really interested what they're talking in other spheres. You know, they want to know what they're planning in economics, what they're doing in Africa, what they're doing here and there. So it's a good sign, right? They really want to know because they're a little bit afraid because it's getting out of control what they're doing in China economic-wise. Yeah.
Very interesting. Well, there's a lot going on, and I'm sure we could talk more about it. But Dr. Patberg, why don't you tell people a little bit about your own research and what it is that you're working on these days?
Well, I'm at Peking University, and I'm working at the Institute for Advanced Humanistic Studies. And what we basically do is we try to facilitate a dialogue among civilizations, and we promote pluralism, what we are talking about. So in a way, we are like the Care Bears. You know, everyone wants to hug us. But politically, we are, you know, we can't do anything. We are scholars. You know, we can write about it, but we have no influence on the politicians, unfortunately.
Well, I wonder what your special Care Bear power would be. That's a good analogy, but very interesting. So people can find your writings online?
Yes, I have a website in East-West Dichotomy.
Very interesting. All right, well, I think we're going to leave it there. Dr. Patberg, thank you once again for your time today.
Thank you very much.